The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
I'm Joe Pinella. I'll be reading The Reason We Can't Have Nice Things by Katina French. Dear Henry, I've been thinking things over since our argument, and I finally recognize the problem in our relationship. The problem is me. I know you've tried to deny it, tried hard to make things work, but it's time we admitted it's over. It's not that I don't appreciate or recognize your efforts. When the Jedi broke out of his pen and totaled your Miata, I think you handled it with remarkable restraint. The time the dragon got loose from the cellar and left the deck and patio set a smoldering pile of ashes? You were the one who suggested we look into recouping some of our losses through the manufacturer's flame-retardant guarantee. It's your practical, down-to-earth attitude I'll miss most. You've handled everything with admirable grace, and I'm grateful for it. You've always understood my work comes first, because lives are at stake. If I'm not there to capture a loose genie or talk some sense into an adolescent troll with raging hormones, who will be? How many people were gored the week we went to Cancun together, and a herd of minotaurs trampled through Chicago? I know neither of us wants another tragic occurrence on our conscience. Cancun was a beautiful week, but I can't help feeling those strawberry margaritas were tainted with spilled blood. I'll be perfectly honest. They may have been. I still have lingering doubts about the Cabana Boy. He had the rangy look of a necromancer in training. The truth is, I don't really have room in my life for a serious relationship. I thought I could manage it. I thought I deserved it. But this isn't about what I deserve or need. It's about what you need, which is to keep breathing and not get turned into granite or eaten by something horrific. We both know that's where this road ends. I would ask you to remember me fondly, but by now the unicorn tears embedded in the paper will have started to seep through your fingertips, erasing your memories of me and the time we've spent together. You'll have a moment of disorientation as the phoenix blood in the ink ignites and burns up this note after you've read it. Please know I deeply regret any pain or future episodes of forgetfulness this may cause you. I promise to remember the good times for both of us. Sincerely, Bridget.
This is Elena Clevenger. Next, I'll be reading A Note to Parents Regarding the Beginning and End of Time Diorama Presentations for Miss Miller's Third Grade Class by Rebecca Schwartz. Dear parents, it's diorama time again, and I thought I would send home a few notes for parents about this annual project. While your child is encouraged to approach this project creatively, there are a few ground rules that will help ensure success as well as the safety of the class. Time. If your child chooses eternalism or brick time, he or she may not use marshmallows, M&Ms, or any other food item to illustrate the discrete blocks of time. Also, while space-time may be infinite, the dioramas are meant to be a representation to demonstrate your child's knowledge of the beginning and end of time. Keep in mind that we have 16 students in the class, and all their dioramas must fit on two tables. Any dioramas depicting n-dimensional space-time, or time foam, must not infinitely generate soap bubbles. It creates a terrible mess. I would recommend restricting any diorama to 6 to 8 dimensions, even if standard string theory's 12 dimensions are achievable. The results are both difficult to view and, in reality, cannot be contained within the confines of the class. Although it has never happened, we would hate to lose a child to another dimension on Diorama Day. Your child may not bring nothing and claim that time, the fourth dimension, is invisible to us. Also, Your child may not bring nothing and claim that he or she actually brought two dioramas. One of the moment of the Big Bang, when all matter was infinitesimally small, and the other of the heat death of the universe, when things are nearly infinitely spread out. Neither may your child bring a handful of marbles, claiming that they represent the moment of the Big Bang, then throw them up in the air and wait until they all roll to a stop and call that heat death of the universe. While this demonstration delighted the class, it was just that, a demonstration. I will be grading dioramas only. Also, it took days to find all the marbles, and they proved to be both a distraction to the class and a hazard to myself. Eschatology. Dioramas representing religious views of the beginning and end of time are acceptable. Please keep in mind that this is a third grade project, and the imagery should be appropriate. For example, the four horsemen of the apocalypse are fine, as is the Eternal City. But a depiction of the Whore of Babylon is inappropriate for a third grade class. At the very least, any such depictions should bear no resemblance to any member of the teaching staff, past or present. Any scenes depicting the last phase of Earth's destruction in Ragnarok cannot involve fireworks or actual fire. I really shouldn't have to bring this up every year. The school's policies regarding fire and fireworks are clearly stated in the district's student handbook. A final note. Last year, a student presented a diorama that illustrated my life as an example of the experience of time. I do not know how he found out that I was born via cesarean section. Both parents and staff felt that the content of his diorama was inappropriate for third graders. While I did award him points for creativity and accuracy, I did not appreciate the other half of the diorama illustrating my death in a fiery car crash on the interstate. I have sold my car and moved to an apartment closer to the school. If this has changed the outcome of the end of my time on Earth, I do not want to know it. All projects are due next Monday and will be judged by the third grade teachers and members of the PTA. Good luck and happy building. Miss Miller, third grade.
Hello. My name is Gerald Rubin, and today I'll be reading Making Time for the Kids by Julian J. Soto. I ran hard from Billings Place to the East Second Schoolyard and saw the sniper at the gate, shooting me in the gut where I fell, died. It hadn't happened like this before. Coming back, I'd changed things. I'd been a survivor of the massacre. Shit. I had no time to think about the ramifications of this change. Like a ton of bricks, I threw myself at the sniper before my kids were among the first casualties splattered all over the green top. I severed his spine with a bowie knife. When he fell forward, I kicked his assault rifle away from his body and grabbed my kids and ran from the yard, pulling Sarita and Manny hard behind me. Hysterical, they looked up at me. Dad? But... I just died in front of them, but here I was, gray-haired, 15 years older, saving them. It's Dad. I ran harder, pulling them home, just a few blocks away. My younger self hadn't faded completely. I thought I might disappear. If I'd had. If he'd had. I didn't know. Nobody did. But I was going to find out about time paradoxes and the butterfly effect in one fell swoop. My kids were crying. I ignored them and rushed into my building minutes later, ringing the bell since I didn't have keys. Sarah came down, so achingly beautiful. I threw my arms around her body. Ronnie, what? I kissed her face everywhere. Wait, she said, noticing the kids were crying. Sarah pushed me away, noting the differences in me. I wouldn't let her go. After the massacre, Sarah had taken 40 sleeping pills. After the massacre, I'd become obsessed with time. After the massacre, I lost my mind and somehow learned things I couldn't have learned before. Sarita reached up and tugged at my shirt. Pappy, Daddy? I pulled Sarita and Manny into an embrace. I started sobbing. I missed you so much. I missed you so much. Sarah stopped pushing me. She hugged me harder. What happened? Please. She started to cry then, and I shut my eyes, waiting to not exist, hoping I'd be able to stay. I didn't know, and I didn't care. I'd save them all. I'd save them.
I'm Emily Keola, and I will be reading Resolve in Four Heartbeats by Kel Raja Salu. It starts like this. I've just reported for an ordinary Saturday shift, exchange nods with Kahiri, and then my heart seizes. The pain lances through my ribcage. I have time to think. A heart attack? And then I collapse and don't think much at all. But it is not a heart attack. After an eternity, I realize I'm on the floor and Kahiri is crouching over me, scanner in one hand, hypo in the other. 4:55, she says. I can see nothing out of order except for the pain. Psychosomatic? I guess, I say. She offers me her hand and pulls me upright. Don't worry. No war has been declared yet. I'll get you water or something. You're very pale. Kahiri goes to get water. I test my feet, shaky, and my heart, shakier, for a certain value of shaky and also a certain value of heart. And my. The moment she's in the bathroom, I run. I know what it was. Not a heart attack. In reality, it started like this, I know. Everyone in the room, full of grim resolve that it was time to stop playing nuclear chicken and start playing nuclear bombardment. Everyone, but President and Jack most of all. Steely-eyed glares, regretful, serious nods, and then cold silence. Surely everything was quiet when the moment really arrived. I hope it was. It went like this. Jack, dead on the floor. The president, staring at him in her hands, because she thought she was killing him for something and discovered that she had killed him for nothing. All the reasons slipping through her fingers like so much blood and awful. I can almost imagine it. Some aide, venturing a careful, is it possible that someone was holding his heart in trust? The president, snarling that this would be treason, or maybe asking for an actual medic to verify that there really was no capsule with the launch codes, it hadn't grown into muscle or slipped in the blood spreading on the floor. Or maybe, just nodding yes, it was possible. I don't really want to imagine it, of course. You can only hold someone's heart in trust if you love them, and whatever really happened, this is constant. Jack handed the president the knife, and they shared a look, as only an executioner and a lamb to the slaughter can. Then she used the knife. You've got to understand death if you're starting a war, you see. I suppose it really started like this. Me and Jack arguing about the good old knife doctrine, together in the dark, in the sticky warm bed. We never were good at pillow talk. We were getting nowhere, really, because Jack argued the party line, that the president only deserved to start a war if she could look at an innocent person in the eye and then kill him, and I kept saying that it didn't really matter, because if she had resolve enough to start a war, then she would have resolve enough to kill someone. Can't be in politics without some ugly military resolve. You are military, Jack said. Where is it? My resolve is not to start a nuclear holocaust, I said. That's where it is. How does murdering one man qualify anyone to kill millions anyway? Jack went really quiet then. I should have figured something was up, but I was warm and content and unguarded, not very observant. I want to say that in a kinder world, he would have said something like, marry me, or even just, I never thought of it this way. But I don't believe in a kinder world, and what he really said was, I adore you. My heart twitched, and I said, I love you too. He really did love me. That wasn't a lie, but it was multitasking. However it started, it ends like this. They catch me on the bridge to the Great North, right on the border. I've passed the checkpoint on our side just fine. I have not yet reached the other. This base, over a raging river right before the falls, is a nothing in between. No country. They don't even have jurisdiction here. But not having jurisdiction has never stopped any of us patriotic civil servants, has it? We are such a great nation. One of them yells my name over the roar of the water. Hands in the air, stay where you are, she adds. I turn, slowly enough not to get shot immediately. The soldier is a nondescript serious woman in a generic red uniform. No insignia. We both know who she is. Who sent her, anyway, which is the only thing that matters. I can almost see the future. I am not as brave as Jack, so I will cry and beg when I really see the knife. The president will not even spare me a glance. She's already a murderer. If she has to kill me to get Jack's heart and make her first murder count, well, that's an exercise in collateral damage. There is a lot of that waiting in the more distant future. I'd be extra credit, really. I look over the soldier's shoulder and think, I'm dead already. My own heart became a mess of bloody meat on a nice white carpet somewhere. The thing beating in my chest is Jack's. Its rhythm is steady. Jack was never terrified, so of course it is. I think he adored me. I think my resolve is not to start a nuclear holocaust. The river is cold and fast, full of rocks and falls and who knows what else. It could be days before they find the body, and by then the capsule in the heart will hopefully be broken to the point of unusability, nuclear codes as illegible as the rest of me. The woman tries to taste me. I jump.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This next story is titled A Conspiracy of Vegetables by Terry J. Babcock. The vegetable woman at the Saturday farmer's market is completely mad. She laughs for no reason at all, and her dirty fingernails and Brillo hair make her look like a street person. But her romaine, her leeks and peas, are the largest and sweetest in the entire market. So we buy from her, my girlfriends and I, nodding politely at her bizarre mutterings, scurrying away with our change and our bags of goodies. "You have marital problems," she says with a knowing wall-eyed squint, one watery blue morning in early spring. The pavement beneath our feet is dark with rain. The air smells of wet earth and sweet young winter carrots stacked in the crate behind us. "I'm not married," I say, but she's not listening. "He doesn't like chard," she says, tisking. "Here, give him these." She pulls a bulging paper package from somewhere and drops it in my bag. The paper is wrinkled and dirty with fingerprints. "Excuse me?" I say. "You'll see," she grins cannily, like a gypsy fortune teller who has just revealed the secret of life. I stand frozen, fighting the urge to fling back at her until a man in a polo shirt pushes past me with an irritated look and a flat of greens. At the corner, I look, fumbling with the crinkling paper. It is a pound of green beans. That afternoon, tucked into the kitchen nook of my flat, I show Suzanne. She is 40, with two boys and a husband who works nights. "Are they magical marriage-mending beans?" she says, tossing back her red wine with a resigned laugh. "Can you give me some?" I give her half the bag and put the rest in the crisper. That night I make Swiss chard and green beans, leaving the beans whole. Colin spears the beans with his fork, but leaves the chard untouched. After dinner he pulls me into his lap, presses his lips against my neck. "Good dinner," he whispers. Late the next morning, Colin and I are still in bed, two soft green seeds nestled safe in our shared shell, when the buzzer rings. It is Suzanne. She looks radiant through her fatigue. Happiness is leaking out of the corners of her eyes. "Tell me where you got those beans," she says. It becomes a ritual for us, visiting Magda. Sometimes she tallies up our purchases and doesn't say anything. But sometimes she looks in our eyes and stops, sifts through our flats of greens carefully, adding some things, removing others. "More basil," she mutters to my girlfriend Charlie, and her brown eyes widen beneath her pixie cut as she watches Magna poke through her box with strong brown fingers. "And fennel. No peppers or tomatoes." She removes the glowing red globes neatly, replacing them with a bouquet of kale, its green leaves ruffled like a woman's bunched petticoats, hiding secrets. "Potatoes in small quantities only. You must not give him so much nightshade if you want him to stop looking at other women." Charlie gasps, then shuts her mouth with a snap. "How do you know?" she squeaks. But Magda only smiles and puts a finger to her lips, inviting us to be co-conspirators. For the lovelorn, Magna prescribes sweet-scented tea of dried apples and rose hips, and fills the hands of my friend whose lover is away at school with grape leaves. "Steam those and eat them with a little lemon. They'll bring her back," she says. "No charge for those. I can't cut them back fast enough." We stop wondering how she knows so much about our lives or why her prescriptions work. Shyly, we coax our friends and family to come to market and share our secret. Then one day she isn't there. Her little stall is forlorn, empty. The other farmers can't tell us anything. Bereft, we buy our lettuces and cucumbers from the others. The next weekend we return, hopeful, but the others have moved their tables, closing the space. The market manager, a practical woman with a gray bob and a face like a horse, sees us looking. "She's gone, all for the best," she says with the certainty of unexamined belief. "She had mental problems, you know. She's in Green Lane. She'll be well looked after there." "She didn't need looking after," I want to say. "Thank you," I reply. Weeks pass. I serve Colin green beans, but the magic is gone. My friends and I go to other markets farther and farther into the country, hoping to find another mad woman with bright eyes and brillo hair who can read the secrets in our eyes, but there is no one. Then, one Friday in late March, I open the mailbox, and out of the pile of flyers and notices falls a lumpy little envelope, addressed to me in cursive hand. It's full of fat, round seeds. Peas, I think. "Plant them," the note says, 3 days before the full moon. Give them your own urine, diluted 10 to 1, stirred Wittershins instead of water the first time, or 20-20-20 if you don't like to use your own pea. I look up Wittershins on the Internet. I scavenge pots and plant the seeds on the fire escape. 5 days later, little green spears appear in the dirt, their tiny leaf nubs tight against the stalk. In 2 weeks, when the peas have their second set of leaves, another envelope arrives, full of pale ovals. "Zucchini," the note says, "full sun. Kiss each seed before you plant. When they're ready, take them to the woman 3 doors down. She has a sad face. Keep a couple for yourself. Don't give her the seeds. She can't grow a thing." I thought I wouldn't know which woman, but when I saw her on the townhouse steps, I knew. Shadows drifted beneath her skin, sadness etched in every line. In midsummer, I left the first of the harvest at her door, rang and hid. I watched her bend for the fruits, shining green like hope, and clutch them to her bosom before disappearing into her house, quick as a thief. I have a council plot now. It's getting hard to bend with the baby so far along. Doris, the sad woman, she and I conceived the same month. She had been trying for 7 years. The shadows in her face are fading like a stain bleached in the sun. I give her raspberry leaf and dill, and of course plenty of squash. More letters came with seeds and prescriptions. For me, a tea of delicate rose petals, sweet mint and marigold. I drank it every day, and gradually I began to see the unspoken longings, the griefs and their remedies, written in the faces of the women I grow for. Each plant has their gift. Butter lettuce to soften a harsh tongue. Romaine for a bad temper. Tomatoes to increase passion. Spinach for courage. Hops for grief.
I sent Magda a letter to tell her how well the peas were growing, how the nasturtium had passed their trellis, twining into the apple tree beside my plot, and how the little girl who ate the bright peppery flowers had overcome her fear and won first place at her piano competition. But my letter came back, stamped, "Patient deceased." Magda's last envelope revealed the secret of her opus, creating a magical seed line that magnifies the intrinsic powers of the plant. Any old seed variety will do to start, but you must believe, you must cradle it tenderly in your belief, as you would cradle a child. Then, like peas on a trellis, it latches onto your faith, and its powers bloom. My daughter is 3 now. She follows me through the garden in her rubber boots, a matching red watering can in her hand. She knows without being told what the plants need. There is something wise and ageless in her eyes, and I thought perhaps I knew who she was. Until one morning I saw Doris's little boy in their tiny yard, squirting urine into a glass of water. He started counterclockwise with his finger before meeting my eyes, his finger against his lips. "George," his mother called, "what are you doing?" Silently, the little boy smiled.
My name is Gerald Rubin. I am reading Inscription on a Monument to the Star Explorer by Ernesto Pavin. To those who were called and replied, "I'll go." To those who fill the void between the stars with dreams of hope. To those who always gaze into another heaven. To those whose hearts beat in time with tomorrow. To those who never said enough. To those who laughed in the face of the void. To those who forsook their home to give us all home. To those who walked on alien worlds with terror in their hearts. To those who fought nightmares so we could have dreams. To those who waged war so we could have peace. To those who built so we would find shelter. To those who finally rest in Mother Universe's womb. Humanity is thankful. Inscription archived under entry TE091945 in the Pan Galactic Archive. The original was destroyed in AY67 due to its celebration of Terran colonial crimes.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.